And welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremen.
And I'm Laura Chan Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. Each week, our two offices come together to celebrate the people and processes that operate behind the scenes to make creative work happen, as well as some of the thoughts and tools that are shaping our industry. While we have a certain focus on advertising, illustration, and animation, the topics and ideas discussed here should hopefully be of universal value to those on both sides of the equation of the applied arts. This podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as the bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence no matter what the medium. Today, we're delivering a new installment in our Extended Open Tabs episodes, where we get to take a bit of a deeper dive into some of the links, tools, and articles that have been circulating in our professional development Slack channel. This week, we'll be covering the seeming decline of ad industry jobs, how to be a better client, and the best art website nobody has heard of yet. But first, how is everyone going? B, how are you?
I just smashed a spin class, so I'm excellent. I'm ready to go.
Do you go anywhere? Like, is there like a video or is there any kind of like thing happening?
I go into my mind. Well, actually, I switch off. No, I don't do like a Peloton kind of class. It's just, although they do sort of dim the lights into this, like, it's this weird red light in, I go to the New York City Sports Club and there's this weird red light in the spin room and it's just kind of like house music, pop music, a little bit of hip hop, and it's just all choreographed to music. And it's really the only thing apart from dance and walking that I really enjoy and that I actually am able to kind of get into. So, yeah.
Laura, how are you going?
I'm all right. I am.
Are you back into the swing of things?
Yeah, I'm just knee deep in like schedules at the moment and trying to wrap my head around that. Otherwise, I'm good. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm okay. I'm not knee deep in schedules. What am I knee deep in?
Well, I think daylight savings is changing this week, which is going to shift
that sucks.
All of my scheduling.
Getting into things, in case you missed it, last year we launched Open Tabs, a series of events we started with our friends at Sample Brewing, which are held inside our clients' offices, where we would take four people with us, two Jack and Winter artists and two plain interesting creative people. A bastard child of Pecha Kucha and Creative Mornings, we gave each person 10 minutes to go over 10 of their Open Tabs for 1 minute each. You can find out more at opentabs.rodeo if you're interested in the full spiel. It's something that we've had heaps of fun doing, as the internet is really our training ground in so many ways. So we decided we'd be expanding our segment previously known as Mini Links into longer episode-wide discussions where we can give some of our favorite topics a bit more room to breathe. So to that end, B, what did you pick for this week?
So I stumbled upon this article from The Atlantic titled, Where Did All of the Advertising Jobs Go?, which immediately piqued my interest. I mean, I thought it would be interesting to just have a little bit of a chat about the state of the industry because a few things came up from this. And to be honest, this was a little bit clickbaity because it kind of, I don't know, it's all a bit semantics. But according to government data, for the first time on record, the number of advertising-specific jobs in the US is declining, which is interesting because we're in the middle of an economic expansion. So for the last three decades, advertising jobs have grown in line with the economy. But today, however, a variety of traditional advertising jobs appear to be in recession mode. So what is happening? Because last year, ad agency jobs fell by 5,000 and employment in media buying agencies hasn't grown since 2013. But we're not actually seeing fewer advertisements. Like, you know, back in the 70s, the average American was exposed to about 500 ads a day, whereas now that number is upwards of 5,000, which is crazy.
Oh, that stat blew my friggin' mind.
I mean, one corporate message roughly every 10 seconds of waking life. Like, and we're not even in like Blade Runner-esque where, you know, we've got like Google glasses and you're taking in so much advertising on screens that aren't an actual screen. So yeah, that is kind of crazy. But I guess the shift, like this decline, it can be attributed to a few different developments that have sort of happened over the last couple of years. The one being technology's invasion into the ad sector, and the other is brands and corporations, no surprise, choosing to move more and more of their production and their media buying work in-house. So you have these big tech giants like Facebook and Google, who are now arguably some of the biggest advertising companies in the world. And with this rise in programmatic advertising.
Tell us what programmatic advertising actually is. Do you have any idea? Because it's one of these words that I see kind of just getting bandied about so much. And I don't know if anyone really kind of understands what it is.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, when we were trying to explain, I guess, like Bitcoin and blockchain and all of those sort of things. I think, Lara, you probably have a better handle on this.
I guess it refers to the use of like software to purchase digital advertising space, as opposed to like the traditional process, which involves like RFPs and human negotiations and sort of manual insertion orders and things. So it's basically just using machines and data to buy ads.
And this worked out really well for Facebook in the election, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that stuff is fascinating, like actually how they price their advertising to clients based on sort of, how provocative advertising is.
Yeah, look, I mean, this article is also coming at a really interesting time because another headline that was coming up last week was all about WPP's worst stock drop since 1999.
Yeah.
So it's kind of one of these things that I think once kind of a conversation starts kind of going in the advertising media, like, you know, you get all these kind of different think pieces like that are kind of on the, I guess, precipice of the similar idea. You know, when I'm looking at our personal experience kind of working with ad agencies, like they don't seem to be getting smaller. Is this a US-centric thing, or like what is this article actually positing?
Well, I mean, it was interesting because just last week, I think it was, we heard that Droga5 laid off 5% of their staff from their New York office. And I'm not sure if that was tied to clients moving or if that was tied to a recent, their sort of second in charge actually being dismissed and leaving the agency. But I think the interesting thing is who is actually creating advertising and how brands are choosing to spend their advertising dollar has shifted. And there was another article that I stumbled across on Ad Age where Procter & Gamble, who are arguably one of the biggest advertisers in the world, the headline on that was they'll cut another $400 million in agency and production costs.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's that the jobs are actually going, they're just shifting to in-house. Because, I mean, Facebook, Google, Procter & Gamble, et cetera, employ a phenomenal amount of creatives doing the same work they would have done in an agency, just they're doing it in-house for the one company now.
Well, and also just the nature of actually what counts as advertising is changing so much. Laura, do you watch John Oliver at all Last Week Tonight?
Yeah, I do.
Last night's episode was amazing. It was all about NRA TV, which is all about kind of like how the NRA as a brand, you know, has basically created, has turned themselves into a media company where they have a whole TV station.
Yeah, them and everybody else now. Yeah.
And they have like, you know, they have like 20 different TV shows, like literally just kind of around guns.
That's
so it's
fucking
like
terrifying.
It is terrifying. And there's one ad agency that kind of, you know, produces kind of all that, you know, content as well. So yeah, I mean, things are shifting. I guess in summary, is this article kind of a warning, or is it just kind of asking a question, or kind of, you know, what kind of drew you to it apart from the clickbaity headline?
Well, I mean, the headline, I mean, that was what originally interested me. But I guess I'm interested, have you guys seen a shift, or is it in the type of work that, you know, we're being commissioned to do, or where the commissions are coming from? Or is it just the same? We're just getting work from different places?
Yeah, honestly, I mean, no, I haven't seen any sort of shift. But then again, I mean, we often get very little insight into how an ad is going to be placed and why it's being created in the first place. Like our role producing the artwork tends to stay much the same regardless of who is commissioning the work or for what purpose. We definitely do get a fair few branded content briefs now as opposed to like sort of more traditional advertising stuff. But this doesn't feel particularly new to me. I mean, what do you guys think?
No, I mean, it doesn't feel new to me either. But I mean, it's kind of like one of these things like where anything else, you have to be kind of like boiling the lobster, you know, like things happen so slowly that sometimes
lobster.
You don't kind of notice it.
Well, I think what was also interesting to me was that you know, ad spending is becoming fragmented with digital. I think one of the other things in the Procter & Gamble article from Ad Age is that they're again choosing not to really invest in a one-on-one relationship with an agency and instead pitch projects out on more of like a project-by-project basis. How do we keep up as content creators? Because I think it means that we need to just work much quicker if things are just coming more in sort of like these bite-sized pieces, as opposed to really being able to put time and effort into crafting something like we would traditionally, like a TV commercial or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame, I think, because I think doing the sort of project-by-project pitch basis doesn't really afford agencies the ability to really get to know a client's market and develop continuing campaigns that build upon each other. And I think, you know, the results of a campaign are not always immediate or obvious. And so it can be a waste to put all your energy into these sort of one-off stunts. But I think the main issue, though, is that this kind of hopping from agency to agency with each project means more pitching, and more pitching means more wasted resources, and now for even less return. You know, at least before, when you're pitching, you might be trying to pitch for a 3-year contract or something. Now it might just be for the one project, and there's really only so much time and energy that agencies can afford to put into pitches, and this is massively decreased if they're having to pitch for each and every project. And so naturally that will sort of drive down the quality of the creative. And I think, you know, these days pitches can span half a year or even longer. So, you know, sometimes you're pitting anywhere up to like a dozen agencies against each other for the one account, and keeping staff in the office until 2 a.m, you know, chasing new business while they're still trying to service the clients that they've already got. And also a high profile pitch generally requires the agency's top tier talent. So you've got senior talent stepping away from the regular client work and the lower rung talent trying to like fill those gaps. And we all know that, you know, that drain that a pitch can put on a team. And so I think it is a very real concern that more pitching could wind up undermining the very services that these brands are actually looking for. Mm.
So much of these things just go back to really dead set basics, which is just that it's like any kind of relationship, no matter kind of what it is, requires like an investment and commitment on both, you know, on both parties. And I think, yeah, like there's, I mean, look, I can't speak for the, you know, these marketing chiefs who are kind of on or behind these processes and making those things happen. I mean, I'm sure there's a certain amount of thrill or kind of fun in that, or I don't know what makes people do that. But you look at some of the greatest brands like Apple, who have had, you know, this these incredibly long relationships with something like TBWA, where they've kind of established their own ad agency kind of within, you know, there. And Apple doesn't really do much. I mean, they do some in-house creative, but yeah, still like some, most of the big stuff is still kind of done outside.
Yeah, I think you get an understanding of the brand and the market that you just couldn't possibly replicate when you're working with a one-off agency. Well, it's not possible.
Well, one of the things I think that's interesting for me working in the US that has been very different to when, you know, working in Australia is because the market here is so much bigger. Like speaking about where jobs are coming from, like I do a lot more work direct to client here, which I kind of really enjoy. Like I enjoy the intimacy of, you know, getting to know one creative services manager very well and understanding their process and understanding their aesthetic really well, as opposed to, you know, like jumping into a new creative team and a new art buyer kind of like on every different project. It's nice to kind of have those long running relationships directly with an in-house creative team.
Well, look, there's a lot of different links and articles that kind of surround this kind of piece. So we'll put all of these up on our show notes and we'll move on to our next link. The next link is mine, which will come as no surprise, came from the Fast Company Design blog. I know. I'm just waiting for them to start paying me for all this amazing promo that I'm doing. But it actually is a bit of a mixed one as well that also kind of comes from Amazon through kind of our book club as well. So if you listened to, I don't know, maybe 10 episodes ago, we did a bit of a book club episode, which is something that we kind of do here every, like maybe twice a year, where everyone kind of picks a book.
Yeah, I think we're due for another one.
We are due for another one soon. And this one kind of shot like right to the top of my list. And this is a book called Dear Client. This book will teach you how to get what you want from creative people. And they kind of, Fast Company does this a bit where sometimes it bugs me, sometimes it doesn't, but that they, you know, they repackage an excerpt from a book as kind of an article. So it's really just an excerpt from the book, which is under the headline, The Top Do's and Don'ts of Working with Creative People, or How Not to Be an Asshole Client. And I mean, look, I'll talk a bit more about this book in a bit more depth, but basically it's written by Bonnie Siegler. Bonnie is voted one of the 50 most influential designers working today by Graphic Design USA. What Graphic Design USA actually is, I have no idea. It could be a completely fake thing, but you know, she has you know, she's done a lot of great work. I mean, you can read that all in her Amazon profile that we'll link to. But the thing that I really loved about this book, it covers
she has a Wikipedia page.
Does she?
She's made it big.
I want a Wikipedia page.
I will just we'll make you one. Blue tick.
We got a spam message. You can buy a blue tick. It only costs $600 and they guarantee their work. Anyway, moving on. The thing that I really loved about that, they focus on this great excerpt that I really liked because it does one thing that I can't really do well, which is make things shorter and succinct. If you listen to this podcast, you probably know that is one of my failings. But they pull out this excerpt called Don't Say This, Say That, and basically puts in kind of things that you shouldn't say as a client, and you know, things that you might kind of say, yeah, how to kind of say it better. And like, I'm just looking over this, like, oh, these are all things that we've covered kind of on the podcast, especially in terms of, you know, how to kind of give feedback and how to lead a creative process. And yeah, I think the way that she's able to do this is just really amazing. It takes a lot of skill to boil them down to their essence in that way. One of my favorite excerpts here is, she says, she realized long ago that her difficult clients weren't assholes or jerks or stupid. They simply didn't know how to work with creative people. And that disconnect consistently leads to frustration. So that's what kind of made her write this book. I guess the one thing that I would kind of say is that the overall design of the book like feels quite aggressive. It's all capitals, you know, condensed sans serif typeface. They're in nice colors, but I was kind of thinking is like, man, it's kind of funny that I kind of like, I would love to have bought this book for all of our clients and give it to them for Christmas because there's some amazing stuff
God,
in there.
Oh, God, no, it feels so aggressive.
But no, it would feel so aggressive. And so that's kind of what I think is kind of funny as well, that the as someone who's a designer trying to get this message across, I can't imagine clients actually wanting to read it. But there's some really good points in there. So I'm curious to hear that. But I guess I'm going to read kind of some of my favorites, and I'm just kind of curious which ones kind of resonated for you. So one thing says, don't say, make it bigger. Do say, I wonder what it would look like if it were more prominent. And there's a whole kind of thing here on kind of handwriting fonts as well, where it says, don't say, use a handwriting font.
I had some
font.
Thoughts on that first one.
On the first one, go for it. What do you think? On the make it bigger.
Make it bigger.
Yeah.
I feel like their do say version is kind of the same thing, just more noncommittal and annoying. Like the do say version is frustratingly wishy-washy to me, and it isn't really direct feedback. Like if someone said to me, I wonder what this image would look like if it were more prominent, I'd be pretty unsure as to whether they, if that was something I actually wanted to try and why. Like, I just think it would be much more useful for all parties if instead they said something along the lines of like, we need to find a way to hero this element more as it's the focus of the design, or we want to make sure this element is
grapes today.
No, we want to make sure this element is the first thing people register. What can we do to emphasize it? Just, I don't know, that wishy-washy, I wonder what it would look like if it were more prominent, seemed useless to me.
The thing that I kind of just like about it is that I guess it depends at what point in the conversation that's happening. And some of these things are a bit out of context, but I like the idea that it explores a bit more of a dialogue and rather just kind of like a do this kind of do that, because I guess that opens up a discussion where it's like, I wonder what this image would look like if it's more prominent. Then someone makes it more prominent and it's like, okay, well, here's what it looks like. This is why it doesn't work. This is why it doesn't work, rather than just kind of doing it. And I don't know.
See, to me, that screamed of, we've all had those clients where they go like, I wonder if it were red. I wonder if it were bigger. I wonder if it's more. And you end up doing 900 versions because they want to wonder about everything.
Yeah, I like that she is posing some open-ended questions, and like rereading some of them now, like I kind of agree with you, Lara, in that some of the actual questions are a little bit wishy-washy, but I use open-ended questions a lot in when, especially I realized when I'm negotiating, you know, if I'm looking at a contract and I'm looking at a clause in a contract, and when I first read it, it doesn't seem fair. I think for me, it can be a lot more beneficial to ask the client a more open-ended question, like, you know, can you explain this clause to me? And then push back if I need to, once I understand the context, rather than just automatically kind of going in defensively and being like, this clause is unfair, please amend. And I think that's what some of these questions are trying to do. They're trying to just, yeah, open a dialogue and allow the client to seek more context and a little bit more about the why that the designer may have done something, to give them more context on how they can proceed to the next step. But yeah, some of them are a little bit odd.
Oh, look, on the other hand, there was one that I thought was interesting, which was kind of taking a flip side of that, which is, don't say I love it in brackets if you don't actually love it, and saying, do say, I think I really like it, but I need some time to gather my thoughts. And I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of literature and training, like, you know, on how to be more aggressive as a creative in terms of presenting your ideas and, you know, things like this. And I think sometimes that does pressure people into trying to into or pressure clients into accepting work that they might not ordinarily accept or they really don't like. I mean, I've noticed a few times where we've done projects and we get to final art and it's like, oh, actually, we didn't kind of like it at all, you know, like, or goes to, like, they wait to kind of voice their opinion. So I do like the fact that it does kind of prompt people to actually say, you know, if you don't like it, yeah, give yourself some space to, you know, to figure that out.
Definitely the one of the ones I resonated with most was the don't say we can't pay you much, but we'll get you great exposure. Do say this is how much we can pay. We hope that works for you. I think, you know, as the one who is in charge of negotiating the budget, this gets me everybody time. You know you have a shit budget, just own up to it and tell us what it is and I'll see what I can do for you. You know, pretending that exposure is, you know, of anywhere near the same value as actual money is frustrating. And, you know, if someone is able to tell us the amount that they're able to spend, I can then focus my energies on coming up with a solution that will actually work. So.
Oh my God, yes. This times a million. And like, yeah. we're very kind of like, I feel like we're pretty transparent with our prices. And yeah. Our job is to make the work happen. Like, you know, so this is one that I was going to bring up that I kind of wasn't crazy about, especially because it's such a big part of our job. Just the fact that this kind of shuts down further dialogue as well. They're just kind of saying this, like her suggestion is, this is how much we can pay. We hope that works for you. And that kind of doesn't feel like there's any kind of opening for further discussion, which 9 out of 10 times there always kind of is. So it's like, well, you know, well, where can we change the scope or where can we look at alternative models of remuneration, all those kinds
of
things.
Yeah, that would be a great addition to that line. I think with this list, there were a lot that I really liked, some that I wasn't like so hot on. But I think the difference here is that really this is kind of speaking to non-creative people, people in non-creative roles on how to work with hired creatives. But for us, we're very often working directly with other creatives. So it does change things a little bit. I don't mind receiving a suggested solution from a creative director, for example, someone who clearly does have a strong creative eye and can contribute constructively. I mean, it's of course a different story if we're working with a marketing manager or something, but generally we're not. So the application of these statements to what we do isn't exactly black and white. And I think some of the beauty of what we do when working with creative directors or art directors or whatever is that there is some sort of sense of collaboration. She's very against them offering any sort of suggestions of solutions, but I kind of don't mind that sometimes. It depends how strict it is and who it is that's giving it. Like, I still obviously want that decision ultimately to be up to the artist, but I don't mind when there's some input.
I actually have my client/art director hat on at the moment, which is something that I don't get the opportunity to do very often. So,
okay. Oh, yeah. You're working on some internal stuff for us at the moment,
and,
right?
And yeah. I'm like, oh God, how do I give feedback as a creative? As a client, yeah.
This is something we talk about so much. And that's such a funny thing though, especially, yeah, when two creatives are together, working on a creative work is inherently fun in lots of ways. Like that's what we like what we're doing. And that's kind of, and I guess that's the final point that I'll address, which is, you know, one says, don't say we need this project to accomplish these 8 goals. Do say this is our most important goal, but here are secondary goals. We'd love to achieve this as well. And I think that's kind of always, I think that it's really the crux of any creative project because there's so many people coming together. Everyone has kind of different things that they want to do. The client has commercial objectives. Creative has creative objectives. You know, the account service might have, you know, internal financial objectives. The artist might have their own personal creative objectives as well. Like so many things are kind of coming together. So I think, you know, really trying to boil things down to, you know, some just really kind of simple and base facts of what you're actually trying to accomplish and giving yourself like just some kind of North Star that to give you that direction is great. I think there's some really amazing points here. I'm really looking forward to getting the book in for our next book club and hopefully we can chat about it on a future episode then. Moving on to our final link. Oh my God, this I'm so excited about this link, Lara.
This is
a hidden gem.
So Selling Out, Selling Art is this website created by a painter named Scott Zonneveld in an attempt to sell off the over 600 paintings that he has in storage. So our colleague Penny stumbled across this and I haven't actually been able to find anything about it anywhere else. So I am really excited to talk about it with you guys today.
Well, I just want to interject here, like in terms of how she kind of found it, because it's so interesting. It's like, so he lives in the Dandenong Ranges, which is kind of where I live and like where Jackie Winter Gardens is. And there's not a lot kind of happening there. And this is a true, hashtag success story. So it's like, we see hashtags everywhere, never use them. But Penny actually kind of goes into the hashtags and sees, and like, this is how she found them. So I just want to say,
what was the hashtag?
I'm going to have to find out exactly what it is, but she keeps like kind of a different list of kind of Dandenong Rangers related hashtags. And that's how she stumbled onto his thing. And that's why I'm so excited, because I think this needs to go viral. I can't believe it hasn't already.
We're going to start it. So yeah, I mean, the idea is simple, but it's pretty novel. I mean, so he puts up a few different paintings each week, and every few seconds, the price of his paintings drops by 1 cent until someone buys it or it becomes free. And from then you could, you know, have it just, you just pay for shipping. So the reason he's done this is because after several years of painting, his storage can't really take much more stuff. And he has no need for the paintings himself. And he says that he isn't as good as he wants to be yet. So he's thrown up this website to see if he can make a bit of cash to put towards more paint and canvas. And he's got this little FAQ on his site, and it asks, are you okay with giving away paintings? And he responds, I've never sold a painting before starting this site, so it isn't much different. Then it asks, does this devalue your work? And he says, maybe, but galleries are the ones who care most about that, and there are fewer and fewer of those around these days. I think all up, he's sold only 3 paintings so far out of 9 that he's uploaded, and he's made a total of $82. The highest sell price was $62, which leaves only $20 for the other two, really. So, I mean, personally, I actually really like the work.
They're gorgeous paintings.
Yeah, it's pretty typical sort of oil-painted Australiana, but that's my vibe. So I would definitely consider buying one. But kind of, like, I have many vibes, but it's one of my minor vibes. But yeah, I'm not sure what price I'd buy one for. And really, like, I've thought a lot about this site, I mean, over the last night, but I've come to the conclusion that I love it. How do you guys feel about this? Does it devalue the work?
I mean, I haven't really gotten to the philosophical implications of it. I love that he's combined 2 things that I really kind of respect, which is kind of, well, 3 things, many things, actually, like this entrepreneurial spirit, disruption of like how things are kind of bought and sold. And he's taken his skills, because he's a web designer by trade, and he's taken that skill and, you know, made this site. It's so kind of simple. He's actually a very talented artist as well. There's so many kind of things kind of coalescing in a really kind of simple way. Like, I'm so surprised no one else has kind of really done it yet. Also, in his kind of FAQ, the next last question, isn't this a gimmick? Yes. And it is a gimmick. And I think it's a phenomenal one. Of course, right after that, can you paint my dog, cat,
no.
child? So he's not up for commission. If you really kind of look into this, the things that it really kind of touches in terms of the value of creative work and art, especially, I mean, it's getting at some real kind of fundamental issues where, well, if he's not valuing the work, I mean, he kind of is, but kind of isn't, you know, it's really kind of up to it is up to galleries and artists and people to kind of say, this is my work, this is how much it's worth. And that's, and it gets,
yeah, and set a precedent of some sort. But that's exactly why my brain first went sort of there. And then I was like, well, this is his property. I kind of start thinking of it as like a garage sale. Like, this is his stuff that he wants to get rid of. It. He can do what the hell he likes with it. His priority here is getting some stuff out of storage and making a bit more money so he can further his practice.
Leveraging.
Yeah, and that's his prerogative. And then I was like, is it even his responsibility to take into account whether it devalues other people's work? And then I just couldn't really come to a conclusion. It was very difficult.
Well, I like the idea of this kind of reverse auction, and especially if I don't know how many people are kind of looking at this site kind of right now or looking at it, but I can imagine, yes, if this was something like eBay and there were kind of hundreds of thousands of people looking at a piece, like the more people that are looking at something, the more a piece might kind of really resonate with somebody. And they say,
then you
like,
want to jump on it.
That's like, yeah, then you want to jump at it kind of right there. But the whole idea that there's this kind of reverse auction, that it's like, it really kind of tests kind of like, okay, well, how much do I like it? Like, do I like it at $100? Or do I like it more kind of $50?
Well, I thought it was funny because there was someone there that I was like, okay, I'd probably pay like $60 for this. And then I was like, but I know that it's going to be free in like a day, so I'll just wait, like, which is terrible.
But then that's the whole thing. Like, if there's a bigger audience,
yeah, though,
like,
demand.
Then that's going to change.
Now's the time to get them, though, because there's a few sitting there for free that no one's taken.
No one's taken. Like, they're 10. And like, yeah, you can get them like shipped to you for $10. I mean, I think it'd be really interesting if they were kind of more abstract and modern pieces to see kind of how it would work. And what if he didn't have his name on it, you know, like this could be like it's just kind of like the Banksy project where he was just kind of selling his work, you know, like as a kind of a street vendor. So I think, you know, there's a real kind of lesson here in kind of branding as well in terms of how your whole kind of persona as an artist or creative is kind of wrapped up in so many kind of other things. But yet then this whole additional layer where how we're using technology and the internet to kind of sell our work and kind of talk about our work. Yeah, like, I mean, I it's a very kind of, it seems like a very kind of thin, superficial conceit, but I think that the more you kind of think about it, yeah, it touches some deeper things. And I'd be really interested to see. I mean, I think he could really expand this into kind of bigger things with other kind of artists, and I'd like to see it kind of happen more. I mean, this is kind
of... It reminded me a little bit of that that website. Is it like Top Hatter? Have you been on this?
No, what's that?
It's so dumb. Oh, God, I got addicted for like 3 days. Poor Mel got stuck listening to me. I'm trying to find it. It's like, it's kind of similar. Like you have these products. It's these like live auctions and the prices are like crazy cheap and they sell. It's a bit different in that like it sells in like 90 seconds or something. Like you have like 90 seconds to get this thing and the price. It's Yeah, and like most of it's like absolute crap, but some of it's, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it. It's kind of like AliExpress, but like in this weird auction bidding thing. It's so crazy. You've got to go on it.
Oh, this looks terrible. This looks like all this dropshipping stuff that we've been hearing.
Oh, 100%. That's exactly what it is. But it's just like weirdly addictive. And most of the stuff on there is like absolutely horrendous. But every now and then there's this amazing shit for like $3.
This is scary. Look at these gloves that have weird black fingers on it.
Oh, that's where I'm at as well. They're claws for digging.
Okay, this website's amazing. And I don't know if I mentioned this before, but as we are now an enhanced podcast with a where we show images at the same time.
Jeremy, you could get this pillow for $7. It says, "I'm not always a bitch. Just kidding. Go fuck yourself." I just feel like that would suit your lifestyle.
Can we please note that to be the episode title, Bianca, somewhere on the show notes? Well, look, I mean, this is it's a funny site. I don't know how it kind of led us here. I had this idea, once for a site where it would be like, you know how like you have Discus, which is kind of like a commenting plugin.
Where
right. So my idea was basically you would just write these really inflammatory articles, but you would have to kind of pay to comment like per word, basically. And so basically it would kind of like, you know, force you to really kind of restrain yourself in terms of kind of what you would kind of want to say and really just kind of bait people into kind of different, you know, really highly controversial topics. Anyway, didn't really go anywhere. It's just one of those late night ideas. But I like how he took this idea. It's a really fun concept. Buy some of his work and make him really famous. So
yeah, let's make this shit viral.
So we can claim.
So we can claim it was us. Maybe we'll represent him sometime as well. Okay, we will put the links to everything we discussed and associated articles, etc., on our show page at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. And if you are signed up to our weekly podcast-specific newsletter, we will send those out every Friday as well at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter is the sign-up form. I said that sentence in reverse, but you get the gist. Moving on, as we like to close every week, the most Melbourne and the most New York thing that's happened to us. Bianca, what's happened in New York?
I mean, I don't think I really experienced or saw anything particularly funny or interesting, but I did do some of my favorite New York related things over the weekend. I hit up a bunch of galleries in Chelsea. I sat at Washington Square Park and people watched. And then I saw Once on This Island on Broadway.
Laura, what about you? What's the most Melbourne thing that's happened in your post-Hawaii life?
Oh, post-Hawaii life. How depressing. Well, on Sunday, I went to a birthday party for a dog. It's the first birthday. It was at a pub, and the pub had organized party bags for all the dogs with treats.
Yeah, that's the whole reason you can go to the parties for the
party. It was all about my nephew, Dusty, who's Jesse's best friend. He's another Kelpie. And yes, it was his first birthday. He was a very good boy. He wore a little tuxedo. The pub themselves put up these like balloons with paw prints all over them. They had these like martini glasses full of dog treats, which was terrible because then all the dogs got diarrhea because schmackos are actually like, they're just crack for dogs, and they're so, so bad for them. Yeah, they had little bow ties for the dogs that came. It was fabulous.
I think we've reached our peak Melbourne with this one. I think.
I don't know. I was at a pub in St Kilda once, and someone brought a pig on a lead to the pub.
That's awesome. I wish I was there for that.
It was a vegetarian, and I can't remember its name, but it ate guacamole.
Just like me.
How about you, Jeremy?
We did have an amazing show opening, our first of the year at Leamington Drive for Alice Eyre, who's been teaching our digital life drawing classes, Looking Glass, in our gallery.
I did one with her recently, and it was awesome.
So good. But yeah, I mean, speaking of peak Melbourne, I just think, you know, Melbournians, they just love food. They really are just, I mean, food is such a Melbourne thing that I can't really put my finger on.
We've got a garlic bread festival this Saturday.
Exactly.
More, just in time for Mel's birthday. It's perfect.
More peak Melbourne activities. But yeah, I mean, this was the first opening at Langton Drive for a year, and it's all Alice's kind of rissos and screen prints of kind of food packaging. And people went nuts for it. It was one of our best openings I think we've had in years. And it's,
and the work is stunning.
Work is stunning. It's a fantastic show. So it's a very Melbourne show.
For the next 2 weeks?
On for the next 2 weeks. So yeah, or maybe on for the next week by the time this episode comes out. So yeah, check out Leamington Drive for that blatant plug. And with that, I think we'll wrap up. Thank you very much, Laura.
Thank you, Jeremy.
You are backwards tonight. Thank you. We're all out of order. Thank you, Jeremy.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Areej Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Not on Vero. We're not doing Vero anymore. We did it for a day.
We were doing Vero?
Yeah, we did it for like a day and then it got weird. We're on Elo, though. We gave Elo another go, so you can check us out.
Oh, that's how
there.
We keep getting emails from them. Yeah, why are we on Elo?
I don't know. Anyway, we're all there at Jackie Winter. You can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/jackiewinter. If you love what you hear, you can help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and commenting too in the iTunes store. Details are on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. We have, I think, maybe 3 or 4 posters left from our bribery operation. So if you haven't seen that, go to our Instagram. We've been kind of doing the rounds posting about that. That's it. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye. But it's just cellophane blowing in the wind. Oh, God. Have you seen the new David Attenborough, not Planet Earth?
Do you do anything but watch TV, Jeremy?
No, this is why I don't have anything else to talk about at the end of the episode. I don't watch that much TV. But anyway, I just can't eat shellfish because anyway.